I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, the far left and the far right are losing their minds about our little podcast. Plus, Mark Mullett files an ethics complaint against Attorney General Bob Ferguson, and a lawsuit is challenging reparations in Illinois. Could our state's new reparations law be next? We'll discuss that and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello, 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 and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I am Brandi Cruz, and have I told you lately that I am having a hell of a good time? I love our jobs. I hope you love your job too, Nicole. Having a freaking blast. Here we are. You know,
we're pretty spoiled.
Just saying how we feel about things, just trying to save this wonderful state of ours, just trying to hold politicians on the right and the left accountable for things that they're doing. And man, it really turns out the ideologues against you. Yesterday, it was the semi-bird supporters. How dare Brandi Cruz? How dare she support a different candidate? The only explanation for why she would support a candidate other than the one I like is that someone's paying her to do it. And here I am, dumb, just doing it for free, supporting Dave Reichert's campaign for free. Maybe I should be charging if they already think that he's paying me to do it. So they just can't fathom, right, that someone could agree with them based on their beliefs and their interpretation of what's happening and what they believe is best for the state. So they come up with nefarious intent. Oh, she's being paid. Someone shadowy, dark money, encouraging her to think a certain way. And today it's the left. Today it's the left wing ideologues who cannot imagine that I would support reversing the Climate Commitment Act for any other reason besides I must be in the pocket of the right. I must be being paid by the right wing to reverse the state's beautiful, wonderful climate policy. I can't possibly be capable. Oh, poor, blonde, sad, stupid me. I can't possibly be capable of forming my own opinions on these things and of aligning myself with organizations of my own choosing who I agree with on certain things. Has to be shady. Absolutely must be. Man, we must be doing something right to have the ideologues so angry at us that they are willing to try to falsely destroy my reputation, which they're not going to be able to do, because that's the only right. It's the only reason. Has to be being paid. This must be a thing. And man, Nicole, for so many people who think I get paid big bucks to have these opinions, why are we still worried about money all the time?
Right.
I should not be worried about money ever. I told Nicole, I said, we can't order new shades, new blinds in the office because I just spent too much money. I don't have the money for it right now. Man, if I was getting the kind of money they think I'm getting from the right and from the left, apparently, I should be in the money. No problem at all. So here's where it came from today. Crosscut and John Stang put out an article that's just an attack piece on me and our friends over at Future 42. Now, I knew this was coming because I did an interview with John Stang about it. Gosh, it's been a couple months now. And it saddens me a bit because John Stang is a fine journalist. He's an independent journalist, and he does sort of contractual work with entities like Crosscut. I think he also does some contractual work with a climate entity, which might be pertinent information in this particular conversation. And John Stang's been fine. You know, in 2014, the first time Governor Inslee was weighing this carbon trading program, the carbon tax, John Stang reported at the time, there's an old article where he reported on the fact that it was going to raise gas prices. And so he's been capable of telling the truth before, but now I think it's John Stang who might be in the pocket of someone. So here's the article. While conservative groups are banding together to dump carbon pricing, Redmond hedge fund manager Brian Haywood is spending millions to end cap and invest. He's got a web of organizations and Brandi Cruz backing him. God, I love this. Okay. It says Project 42, a three-year-old nonprofit working to change the course of Washington state to prioritize free markets, personal liberty, and an individual's right to prosper, God forbid, has its fingerprints all over current conservative efforts, including the drive to kill Washington's new cap and invest program. Project 42, through its communications branch, does financially support conservative political podcaster Brandi Cruz, an outspoken critic of the cap and invest program. Okay, I can keep reading, but I have more to say on that. Cruz has called for state Senate transportation leader, Senator Marco Elias, to be recalled by voters because the two disagree about how revoking the Cap and Invest program will affect funding for transportation projects. She also declared that state public lands commissioner Hillary Fans criticized the use of cap and trade invest money to buy scattered bits of forest, an allegation that Fans' department says is not true. All right, so that's how they're framing this story, and we'll get into the individual accusations. Basically, Crosscut is suggesting in this article that rich people on the right are paying me to oppose the CCA, that rich people on the right are paying me to push for the repeal of the CCA and to call for the recall of State Senator Marco Elias and to push back against these climate policies. I'll reiterate for any of you who would believe that that might be the case, that that's simply not true. I'll get into more on that in a moment. And Crosscut has no evidence that that's true. And so this whole article is built on really just a bunch of assumptions and pieces that John Stang and Crosscut are trying to fit together that don't fit together. It's just like taking like the kids game, you know? This is what Crosscut is doing. Remember that kids game where it's like a board and it's got a couple holes cut in it? And one is a star and one is a square and one is a circle and one's a trapezoid. And what Crosscut and John Stang are doing is they're taking that square block, like a three-year-old, and they're just banging it against the circle hole, hoping it fits. And it doesn't, but they just keep banging it, and it doesn't fit. And so what they do is they just cut it in pieces, saw it in pieces, and shove it through the circle hole anyway, because they're just desperate to make this narrative that they've concocted in their minds fit. So a couple things there. So Project 42 is the kind of parent organization of Future 42. And we do advertising with Future 42. Future 42 is one of our wonderful partners on the podcast that we decided to partner with because we believe ideologically in their mission. I believe in what they're doing. And so what they do is like any advertiser on their show, just like our weight loss advertiser or our insurance advertiser, they give us money to do a segment every week on the show that they sponsor. Now, they don't have any control over what that segment is. You know, they can't tell us, here's what we want you to say. That's in our advertising agreement. You had just like Dr. Coogan with Eastside Weight Loss Clinic couldn't call me up and say, Brandi, I want you to come out against this on the show today. Do it or I'll pull our ads. Well, we'd pull our ads because they have no ability to tell us what to do. And they know that. And they would never ask. Just like Future 42 would never ask me to say something or direct me or expect me to say something on our show. The second they did is the second I'd lose all my integrity and the second we'd cut them as an advertiser on the show. Now, they are certainly a unique advertiser. They are an organization that is pushing for, as Crosscut said, free markets, personal liberty, and an individual's right to prosper. Okay, I love free markets. I love personal liberty. I want individuals to have a right to prosper. Yeah. Hell yeah, that's an organization I want to align myself with, and they want to spread the word about their mission. So they advertise on their show, they sponsor a segment, I talk about whatever I want to talk about, and they sponsor it. But again, they have no editorial control over the show, and anyone who's known me for long enough would know that I would never give anyone editorial control over the show, except probably Nicole, who has editorial control over the show because she is the executive producer of the show. So it's interesting. I would also say before I dive into the ins and outs of this story, I think there's a relevant conversation to be had about media funding these days in a lot of ways. You know, we've talked about it. I wrote a whole article about it. I should re-up it about, you know, Jonathan Cho with Discovery Institute and government entities trying to say, you're not a reporter, Jonathan Cho, because you're aligned with this think tank when he's out there doing journalism. So there's a debate about that. You have the Seattle Times and their Project Homelessness that's funded by outside left-wing entities. And they have the Climate Lab, which is funded by outside left-wing entities. I don't see anybody complaining about that. And I don't really have a problem with it either, as long as the Seattle Times is capable of maintaining its editorial control over the content. Someone can sponsor a Climate Lab or a homelessness beat because they think it's important work for the community. because they think what the Seattle Times is doing is important. That doesn't mean, and I don't believe that the Seattle Times, I give the Seattle Times the benefit of the doubt on that, that they're not calling up the Ballmer Foundation or whatever it is and saying, what story do you want us to do today? So for me, I don't really care where funding comes from for a news entity or organization. TV stations, networks, what do they operate off of? Ad revenue. Do you think every single commercial you watch from Fox News has an advertiser who has its finger on the pulse of what Fox is doing and Fox is under their thumb? No, they just pay to run ads. So this isn't new stuff going on. But I love our project our partnership with Future 42, and I'm really proud to be an ambassador for them, which means that sometimes I go around and speak at their events and talk about the importance of the things they push for. You know, limited taxation, safe communities, individual liberty. Man, this is really controversial stuff. So let's carry on with this cross-cut reporting from John Stang, because it's just terrible journalism. There are factual inaccuracies in it. In fact, I've already texted John Stang this morning and said, who do I have to contact at Crosscut to get these factual inaccuracies clarified? Because I don't like when people lie about me. And I don't like sloppy, lazy reporting. And it shouldn't be coming from John Stang, who's a seasoned journalist. Some of this stuff is like reporting 101, like a college journalist should have been able to put the pieces together. So let's read on, shall we? Cruz's podcast has also gone on the offensive beyond mere policy differences on Let's Go Washington and Initiative 2117, which is the initiative to repeal cap and trade. Mark Elias, chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee, has posted several tweets claiming that revoking the cap and invest program will have a ripple effect on the state's overall transportation budget, leading to the potential losses of bridge and road projects unrelated to the Climate Commitment Act. In her podcast, Cruz called for voters to recall Leas because she believes he's lying with the intent to scare voters with falsehoods. True, I did do that. I'll do that again today, by the way. We should recall Senator Mark Elias. John Stang goes on to write, if the cap and invest program is revoked, the legislature will lose a huge revenue source and will have to renegotiate countless details of transportation spending, requiring extensive talks on what to preserve in the projects currently funded by cap and invest and what non-cap and invest funded projects would be cut in the effort to compensate for that revenue loss, Leas said. Quote, it's a case where if you pull the thread, you create a big hole. Cruz disagrees with that explanation. And he quotes me, because I did an interview with him. I told him it's a lie. It's gaslighting. He still won't acknowledge it. And then he goes on to say, she did not contact Leas for his comments prior to calling for his recall. Can you imagine that phone call? Hey, Senator Leas, I just wanted to let you know in advance that I'm going to call for people to recall you. Just thought you should know. Like, I'm giving you a friendly heads up here. John Stang, I don't do journalism. I'm a political commentator. Now, I believe I have my journalistic integrity intact, where I do want to get things correct and accurate on the show, and I strive to do that. But Mark Elias tweeted out lies. I don't need to call Mark Elias to confirm that his lies are in fact lies. I know they are. Just like I don't need to turn on the news and see if the meteorologist is going to tell me that it's raining outside when I can look out my window and see that it's raining. I don't need Mark Elias to confirm to me that he lied. And I certainly don't need Mark Elias' permission to call on voters to recall him. So that's just silly. Now, I will say in this whole article, John Stang is painting it as a difference of opinion that Senator Mark Elias' tweets, which we've covered on the show, are innocent. That he's basically saying, look, if we lose the CCA money, then all these other transportation things could be at risk. Remember the fear-mongering tweets he was sending out saying, oh, we couldn't repair bridges and potholes and roads. But there were some that were even more egregious than that and even more menacing. And he knows exactly what he was doing. And again, a college journalist could figure out that what Mark Elias was doing was stretching the truth in order to influence voters. Mark Elias was specifically sending out tweets that were directed at purple areas of the state, at areas of the state that had critical transportation projects underway, that Mark Elias knows, hey, if I scare that community enough into thinking that that transportation project they desperately need will not come to fruition if they repeal the CCA, man, that gives us a leg up in November. He did it, for instance, if you've ever taken Highway 18, exit 25 off I-90. It's backed up 4 miles to get off at that exit every single day around rush hour. And what Mark Elias said, and that's Issaquah, right? Snoqualmie, that's a purple district. It's the heart of it. It's the most purple district in the state, I would argue. And they desperately need the expansion of Highway 18. If you've ever driven, it's a nightmare. So what does Marco Elias do? Smart. He recognizes that. Hey, that's a prime area, purple district. They are desperate. People sit in traffic waiting to get off at that exit on I-90 for hours every day. It backs up 2 miles. So let's tell them that that project that's already underway, that the funding's already been allocated for, let's tell them that that's in jeopardy if they repeal the CCA and climate funding that has nothing to do with that project. It's a lie. It's clear. I don't need Marco Elias to admit to it being a lie for me to call it a lie, and journalists shouldn't expect Marco Elias to admit to it being a lie for them to call it a lie. It's just a lie. He did the same thing with the project in Spokane, that folks over there are going to Spokane, the city of an increasingly purple area. So he's like, oh, Spokane project you desperately need? Don't repeal the CCA, or we'll just have to stop that thing in its tracks. He needs to be recalled, and I said he needs to be recalled, not because some shadowy right-wing group is paying me to say it, but because he's a liar. And I don't think liars belong in elected office. And I don't think someone who would prey on a family, a working-class person's absolute desperation to have a traffic situation resolved in order to keep the CCA so he can line his pockets and his buddy's pockets, that is certainly not someone who belongs in public office. Again, I said yesterday, I'm saying that for free. Maybe I should ask someone, hey, for money, give me some money and I'll call for Marco Elias to be recalled again. For the love of God, I'd also know, after I spoke to John Stang and did this interview for this story, I realized in 1 second, he'd already written his story in his mind, and he just was there to like check boxes. Because the questions during this interview, and I told Nicole afterwards, I said he didn't write anything down. And I told John Stang this while we're sitting there at a coffee shop. I said, are you gonna write any of what I'm saying down? Because he'd ask questions and point things like this out, and I'd have a retort like the one I just gave. Yeah, he's lying. Here's why he's lying, John. He's intentionally targeting purple districts to influence voters. How can you not see that? It's as plain as day. He's not writing any of it down. So after the fact, I emailed John Stang. I have the email here. April 9th, I said, hi, John. I wanted to provide you with a few links and an update on the things we discussed today. I've got to say, I really felt like the interview was just checking a box and you already have your narrative in mind. I didn't sense any interest in documenting my arguments on the two CCA issues you brought up. So I'm throwing the links here in an attempt to reiterate. Because again, he asked me about the two things he's claiming that I, you know, was wrongly reporting. He asked me that during the interview, but when I gave him my answers, he didn't write a single thing down. So that's why I was like, well, I better email him and just reiterate it. And I put the links into Marco Elias's tweets. John, look at these. You see what he's doing. Just call it what it is. It's a lie. Now, the other issue that John Stang brings up is something we talked about quite a bit on the show related to the Climate Commitment Act, and that is the purchase of 2,000 acres of working forest and how CCA money to the tune of $70 million was spent to buy these 2,000 acres of forest and shut them down. And we talked about on the show about how that doesn't do anything for the climate. That does nothing for the climate, because what it does is then that those forests are going to fall into old growth and they're going to stop sequestering carbon. And there'd been ample evidence that that money could have been better used elsewhere. So John Stang writes in his article, in another podcast, Cruz criticized the state's purchase of a 2,000-acre chunk of forest with $70 million in cap and invest money, saying even Commissioner of Public Lands Hillary Franz opposed it. In reality, the 2,000 acres is spread among several chunks from 5 counties that connect pieces of wildlands with each other. And that is the one thing I will admit I got wrong. That's the one thing. See, I'll admit when I got something wrong. I have no problem doing that. I thought it was a 2,000-acre forest, intact, full. But what John said, and I later verified after we chatted, is it was 2,000 acres in total, but those chunks were spread out. So that's the only thing I got wrong, and I'm willing to acknowledge that. I don't think it's a particularly huge detail that changes my opinion on it whatsoever. But John Stang reached out to DNR and got this gem of a quote. The Cruz report was wrong. Commissioner Franz has long believed that we can and must conserve vital habitats while strengthening and growing our working forests. The $70 million the legislature allocated in 2023 allowed us to achieve both these aims. We were able to conserve 2,000 acres of critical forests adjacent to high-value conservation land, which will improve fish and wildlife habitat connectivity and avoid isolated fragments of conservation. It also funded the purchase of more than 9,000 acres of working forests in southwest Washington, said Michael Kelly, a spokesman for the Washington Department of Natural Resources. And then Stang ends this graph like this. In an interview, Cruz stood by her story. She did not contact the Washington DNR prior to her story. Now, a couple things that John Stang does not note. We never said that Hillary Franz specifically was opposed to this $70 million buy. Never said it. Provide me with my podcast where I said Hillary Franz came out and was opposed to the $70 million in CCA spending. Never said it. What I did say, however, is that Hillary Franz is on the record in a speech she gave in November of 2023 saying that she believes it's a dangerous sentiment to suggest that shutting down working forests is somehow good for the climate. Roll the receipts.
Those who want to stop timber production and forest management are wrong. They're dead wrong. They're wrong on the climate science. They're wrong on the economics, and they're wrong on the impacts to our state and our environment. The notion that our public lands would just take care of themselves if humans never step foot onto those lands is dangerous. It is truly dangerous.
She called it dangerous. Do you think John Stang said that in his story about how closing these working forests is a great thing and, oh yeah, let's use this money to buy it? No. Except in a follow-up email, I had brought this up to John Stang. I said, no, I didn't say she supported the $70 million specific line item in the budget. I said, and we played on the show, what she said in November about how it's not science to suggest that closing down a working forest would somehow sequester more carbon and help the environment. So John, I told him that she said that. I provided him a link again after the interview so he could see it for himself and didn't have to do the work, so he could just click on the button and watch it. No mention of that whatsoever in the story. I also mentioned to John Stang and provided him a link after our interview to the fact that on this line item, the $70 million buy, that DNR testified before a committee in Olympia, and DNR admitted that it would be a better use of that money, acre per acre, carbon to carbon. It would be a better use of that money to buy up, let's say, areas that are prone to wildfire. Roll the receipts.
Would you sequester more carbon by reforesting 20 acres than you would setting aside 1 acre of carbon dense forest and sending it to old growth?
So if the question is, you know, what is the best utilization of Climate Commitment Act funding, I think my earlier answer, acquiring lands at a risk of conversion is going to do more, I think, as that for that carbon benefit than setting aside forests, than potentially even doing reforestation, because again, once that land is now no longer forest land, it stops. It is not going to sequester any more carbon.
Wow, isn't that fascinating? No mention of that in John Stang's article. It's like he ignored my email entirely, like he sat across from me at a coffee shop and tuned out everything I said, unless his ear perked up and it's something that fit his narrative, that I'm only saying these things and taking these positions because someone's paying me to do it. Nothing in that DNR quote, by the way, about their own guy and the commissioner of public lands both saying, hey, yeah, that's probably not the best use of this money. It could be better used elsewhere. Totally ignores it. I also just want to point out real quick that John Stang's assertion, in an interview, Cruz stood by her story. She did not contact the Washington DNR prior to her story. Now, I don't know if we contacted her prior to ever talking about it, but here's an email. And I provided this email to John Stang. I forwarded this email to John Stang. Nicole reached out to DNR to invite Hillary Franz on to talk about this exact story and even followed up a couple days later when they hadn't responded. This is Nicole to DNR. This stuff's too good. And John Stang had all of this. Yet he still put out the article he put out. I produce the Undivided with Brandi Cruz podcast. We've been talking about the legislature in its 2023 budget funding the closure of working forests in the name of climate commitment. We're hearing more could be allocated this year. We've seen Commissioner Franz speak out against shutting down these forests, explaining it does more harm than good. We would love to talk with her about it. Would she have time for a Zoom call this week? Anytime after 1 p.m. works for us. Please let us know. Nicole, in a follow-up, hey, just checking in on my previous request. Sometimes these things end up in junk mail. Please let me know if the commissioner would be interested in talking to Brandi. Crickets. And by the way, when I sent John Stang the email with all the information I told him about at the coffee shop that he never wrote down, I'm to expect that he just kept it all in his noggin. Well, it didn't end up in the story. A couple days later, I sent John a text. And I said, hey, John, just in case, maybe he didn't get the email. On the number we'd been texting to set up the interview. Hey, John, just making sure you got the email I sent out with the information that we talked about. I just want to make sure you got it. Never heard back. Never heard back. So there's no excuse for it. It's incredibly dishonest. And what I'll bring it full circle to one of the things I said earlier. I think it's perfectly fine to look into how the media is funded. What I'll say, first of all, John Stang asked me, how much does Future 42 pay you for advertising? And what I told him is, it's none of your business unless Crosscut wants to open its books to us. If you go to Crosscut and Crosscut wants to open its books to us so we can know how they're funded and who's funding them and how much individuals pay and their subscribers and all of that, that's fine. But unless you're willing to do that, then my advertising rates are none of your business. Now, Crosscut, what you could do is if Crosscut wants to advertise on the Undivided podcast, we'll send them our rates. Our rates are the same virtually for depending on what the advertisement partnership entails. They're all roughly the same. And we're monthly. And we're talking about a couple thousand dollars. I'll put it in the ballpark. A couple thousand dollars a month. You really think that I can be bought for a couple thousand dollars a month? That my opinion can be bought for a couple thousand dollars a month? I quit a $200,000 a year job to do this podcast. And you think that someone throwing a couple thousand dollars a month at me for advertising for services rendered is enough to buy my opinion and buy my integrity? That's because that's what Crosscut is claiming here. Man, how many people do I have to sue this week? Can I sue Crosscut for this? Because that's the insinuation that they're making. I can't possibly think for myself. I can't possibly think for myself. But again, to bring it full circle, if they want to have this conversation and look into, oh, who's funding who and how might that influence their reporting and actually genuinely ask, because I offered John Stang, I said, I'll give you the contract that we have with Future 42, which clearly says that they have absolutely no editorial control over our content. He never wanted it or asked to actually get a copy of it. Where is the Crosscut investigation on who's funding the Seattle Times Climate Lab? So, right, that's fair. Again, if I think that it's fine for the Seattle Times to have outside entities helping to prop up local journalism, as long as they have no editorial control over the content. But here's what the Seattle Times Climate Lab says. About the Climate Lab. Climate Lab is a Seattle Times initiative that explores the effects of climate change in the Pacific Northwest and beyond. The project illuminates the impacts of heat waves, drought, wildfire, and flooding, and examines government and industry actions to help the public better understand how greenhouse gas emissions are changing our lives. And then it goes into how it's funded, which they say it here. And to act like it's some, I have a secret partnership with Future 42. I've put out videos with them saying, I'm so proud to have this partnership with Future 42. And we say before the segment, it's brought to you by Future 42. So I'm not sure how to make it more apparent. But the Seattle Times Climate Lab, let's see here who pays for it. The project is funded in part by the Bullitt Foundation, Mike and Becky Hughes, University of Washington, and Walker Family Foundation, and its fiscal sponsor is the Seattle Foundation. And the Climate Lab brings you such stories as more than $156 million for solar panels coming to Washington communities, a future without natural gas, new law involving PSC aspires to set the course. Stories from the front lines of climate change in the Pacific Northwest, eroding shorelines, wildfire, and dead fish. So you have the Climate Lab, which clearly takes a very left-leaning perspective on climate change and has been repeatedly called out by Cliff Mass for demonstrable inaccuracies, data inaccuracies, that we've had him on the show to talk about it, that he laid out the data, laid out the story about like snow melt and snow cap, and said it's clearly wrong. Cliff Mass would email them and say, hey, you should correct this. And they never would. So why isn't Crosscut interested in getting to the bottom of what's happening at the Seattle Times? Hey, you're pushing all these very left-wing narratives on climate change, and you're funded by these outside entities. How much do they pay you? How much do they pay you? Are you taking those positions because they're telling you to do it? Because that's what he's asking of me, and I'm just a little old podcast. That's the Seattle Times. You know the other key difference? I'm a political commentator. They're a journalism outlet. So if anything, if a journalist cap, was to decide, if they had to pick between the two, should I talk about how this podcaster is influencing the CCA, or should I talk about how the Seattle Times climate coverage might be influenced? And I can guarantee you that these big ticket donors that the Seattle Times, that fund the Seattle Times Climate Lab, I can guarantee you that they're giving them more than a few thousand dollars a month. I can guarantee you that the Seattle Times Climate Lab is getting far more money than we get from any of our individual sponsors. They also conveniently leave out when they criticize and say, shadowy right wing, blah, 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 that it's that half of our revenue comes from you. That half of our, we would not be able to do this show without subscribers who pay $5 a month. So it's like, funded by all these rich people. No, we're funded in large part by regular people who enjoy what we're doing. And they always seem to leave that out. So John Stang, Crosscut, I'll be in touch for some, maybe I should offer you some training on journalism. Who would have thought you had to do it? But I'm always happy to put my journalism cap back on and say, hey, maybe when someone provides you detailed information in an interview, you should write it down so you can use it in your story. Or maybe when they follow up via an email with links and stuff, you should actually watch the links and then include that in your story or read the email at all or something like that. So it's just really wild stuff. But the far right ideologues, the far left ideologues, they just cannot believe that I have personal opinions that I share on a podcast that's entire purpose is for me to give my personal opinions. Wow, shocking stuff. All right, Mark Mullett strikes again. State Senator Mark Mullett, who's running for governor as a Democrat, a moderate, who's just been shunned by his own party. Talk about someone who gets it from the fringes. Mark knows what that feels like. So Mark Mullett has now filed official complaints against Bob Ferguson over, I'll just play the clip here. We've played it a couple times, over Bob Ferguson's request that the Secretary of State break the law for him.
After the drawing of straws on Friday afternoon, one of these Bob Fergusons will appear second on the ballot. The other will appear third on the ballot. And I appear number 13 on the ballot. So we're asking the Secretary of State to either move my name up, sort of second essentially, above those two, or move them down below me.
Yeah, move them down. So didn't take, again, I think Secretary of Steve Hobbs in an interview with the Washington State Standard said it would take a first-year law student to recognize that I couldn't do that. Yet the Attorney General of Washington is asking me to do that. And then we knew from Jason Rant's reporting that Steve Hobbs was caught on a hot mic saying that A.G. Ferguson called him, too. And when Steve Hobbs said, I can't do that, he said, bullshit, you can push the envelope. That's the Attorney General demanding the state's elections chief break the law for him. So Mark Mullett has filed ethics complaints. And the Ferguson campaign's already acting like this is some desperate act from Mark Mullett because he's behind in the polls or whatever it is. No, someone had to do this. This is the right thing to do. And I honestly, even if Mark hadn't been running, I think Mark still would have done this. This is from a press release from the Mullett campaign. On May 13th, Bob Ferguson violated common known rules about lawyers recusing themselves from cases where they have a conflict of interest, along with Washington State executive ethics rules about not using the power of your elected office to benefit your political campaign. He references a state bar code was violated by Bob Ferguson on May 13th when he applied verbal pressure to the Secretary of State, Steve Hobbs, to rearrange the order of where candidates would appear on the ballot for governor. In a phone call with Secretary of State on May 13th, Attorney General Bob Ferguson learned that the occupations would be listed next to each Bob Ferguson on the ballot so voters could differentiate between the candidates. But the ballot order would not be rearranged to list himself ahead of the other Bobs. A.G. Ferguson then applied verbal pressure on Secretary of State Steve Hobbs in violation of RCW, which is about the order on ballots, and rearranged the ballot order as the Ferguson campaign legal team had already demanded in their memo earlier that day. So you've got ethics complaint, bar association complaint, entirely appropriate. it is shocking to me. I actually think King 5, I was going to talk about it today, but man, I got lost in the sauce on the cross-cut story. One of them did it. I want to say it was, King 5 did an article, A.G. Bob Ferguson defends campaign letter about the other Bobs, and he just thinks he's in the right. He doesn't see any problem in the world with what he did, and that's the whole issue. We've said before, this whole Bobs thing, you know, putting two other Bob Fergusons on the ballot, like, as misguided as it was, it really showed people, if they hadn't seen it already, Bob Ferguson's true colors. I think about Donald Trump, not to bring Donald Trump into it, but remember the phone calls he was eviscerated over, like to the Georgia elections chief? Hey, you need to find however many more votes. That's what he was accused of. How is this any different? How is it any different? You could argue the scale, right? But Democrats lost their ever-loving minds over that. So Donald Trump is a horrible person, unfit to be the president, for calling the Georgia elections chief. And Bob Ferguson, though, he's perfectly within his right and righteous to call and pressure the Secretary of State, even after he's already said no, to change the order on the ballot in violation of RCW, and to tell him, bullshit, you can push the envelope, when he's told no and throws a temper tantrum. Bob Ferguson has a hell of a lot in common with Donald Trump, it turns out. Maybe they should be friends, you know? Maybe Bob Ferguson should stop fighting Trump and they can be buddies. So it's just crazy. So good for Mark Mullett. You know, and this is going to get him shunned even more by his own party, but he's already persona non grata with the Democrats in Washington State. So he's doing the right thing, and we'll follow it. But, you know, Bob's got all his buddies in the bar, you know, and all his buddies in government, and I highly doubt any judge or anyone will go against Bob Ferguson, but we shall see. That felt good. That felt nice. Has anyone commented on Old Abe over here?
Maybe not specifically Abe, but they noticed the new setup here.
Yeah, you know, look, the new studio is a work in progress. I was here till 9:30 p.m. last night, refinagling things. Poor Nicole, this has happened the last 2 days, where she comes in and I've changed things. And she's like, and I'm like, well, okay, but it'll look fine.
We tried to perfect my shot today, but then it got screwed up again right at the last minute.
And so we won't see you again today.
Possibly not.
First of all, I'm not. I mean, I'll take half blame for that. I'll take half blame.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean,
you look pretty good in it.
Well, even why don't you show them my little cutaway shot?
Okay, hold on.
Oh, she's taking off her coat. She's taking off her jacket. Well, before you do that, I'll read Wes.
Okay.
If you're thinking about selling your home at some point in 2024, I highly recommend going with our friend Wes Jones of sellwithwes.com. Bryce and Carla, fans of the Undivided podcast, did when they decided to sell their home in Bellevue and retire to Florida. But they were a little concerned, understandably so. When they sold their home in January, the market was a little, interest rates were not good. And they're like, God, are we going to get what we want for our home? And Wes just assured them, you just follow my plan and we'll get you there.
His attention to detail, he was extraordinarily detailed, and he knew our neighborhood and our properties in the neighborhood very well. He gave us a really great comp plan, showed us what other properties were selling for, and most importantly, he helped us to understand the dangers of overpricing. And we thought what we knew we could get for the property, but we didn't, you know, at the same time, he breathed an air of reality into us, said, look, guys, you want to get that out of the property, you're going to need to start at a certain point, and you're going to let the market come to you. And that's exactly what happened. He was exactly right about that.
Yeah, and they sold their home in 7 days, even in January with the market the way it was, over list price. So sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. He's been doing this for a long time in this market. He's going to know what needs to be done in the neighborhood you're selling your home in. Chances are he sold a home in that neighborhood before. So sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. And he's a cool guy. A better way to sell. He always comes in. Sorry, let me finish the tagline. A better way to sell your home. It always comes in a leather jacket. And I'm like, you're so cool, Wes. How do I be cool like you?
Should we show him the new shot? So first of all, we have this new option for a shot. Oh, fancy.
Yes.
So at some point I might take that. Yeah, that'll be cool.
You know, maybe if I get too intense, then you can just...
Okay. There. Yeah, yeah.
You know.
And then here's my shot, which is just not perfection yet. So we're working on it.
It's just because, yours is good, but it's not supposed to be this shot next to you. Anyway, you guys don't care. You don't care. Sorry. Really care. It'll be fine on Monday. It'll be great on Monday.
And you know, somebody did mention Lee Abe. And she, where is she? Says that it's a shout out to Whatcom County because
yes, yeah, we did. So should I tell the story really quick about Abe and then we can move on with our lives?
Yeah, do it.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
So Abe Lincoln, I was speaking to the Whatcom County Republican Party and they had sort of a silent auction thing.
Yes.
And all these tables full of stuff, and I saw old Abe over there. I was like, gotta have it. So I had to do, I was like talking, you know how those events get. I was like, Nicole, you gotta watch my bid. Because I put a little bid down. I was like, you gotta watch my bid. Like a hawk, and because the table's closed.
Right.
And you're, you know, somebody comes in there and just sneaks it from you. But I got him for like, what, $100?
I don't know, something like that.
I think it was 75. 75 bucks or something?
Yeah. So Joanna Shaver, she must have been there. She recognizes Abe.
And then I carried him around. He's my best buddy.
Yeah.
I really hope to see you guys on Saturday. Just a reminder that we're going to have a super signing event with our shady, dark, right-wing friends at Let's Go Washington. Yeah. Oh, should I? Am I being paid to be there, Nicole? No, I'm not being paid to be there.
If you were, I'd take half.
No one is paying me to do these super signing events. And I'm going to be at this thing for freaking 5 hours. You know how much 5 hours of my time is worth? Quite a bit. But I'm doing it. Brace yourselves, Crosscut. Brace yourselves, Semi-Bird supporters. I'm doing it because I believe in it. And because I believe that securing natural gas as an option for residential and business people moving forward is a good thing. It's a good thing for the working class. So I am volunteering 5 hours of my day on Saturday to collect signatures for Initiative 2066 in Bellevue. No, Brian's not paying me. Although, gosh, I'm saying, if people are just going to accuse me of it anyway, maybe I'd ought to cash in and then donate it to a worthy cause. Who knows? Anyway, we're going to be in Bellevue Saturday, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Nicole will be there too.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And it's going to be at 222 112th Avenue Northeast in Bellevue. It is a joint super signing event between myself, Let's Go Washington, and the Building Industry Association of Washington. So speaking of, we have been trying to, on the show pretty regularly, talk about the need to really get going on collecting signatures for Initiative 2066, because we only have until July 5th. So we have to collect 405,000 signatures in just over a month. It's a much shorter timeline than what we saw with the other initiatives, which were to the legislature. So the reason the Building Industry of Association of Washington is so passionate about collecting enough signatures for Initiative 2066 is they know what the implications will be. They know that if people are forced to electrify their homes, if builders have to deal with a situation where they've got projects or whatever and they've got to move from gas to electricity, all it's going to do is cost people. It's going to make housing less affordable. It's going to make rental housing less affordable. It's going to be the antithesis of what Democrats say they want to achieve for housing in the state of Washington. So Greg Lane with the BIAW was nice enough to join us today to talk about the dog they have in the fight. Greg, welcome to Undivided.
It's a pleasure to be here, Brandy. Thanks for having me.
They can take my gas stove out of my cold, dead hands. Too aggressive.
I was at an event on Saturday. The people are fired up about this, and rightly so, because the cost that homeowners are going to have to bear, to make the conversion, you're talking $40,000 to $70,000 plus higher utility rates before that. I mean, you know, the consumers really been sold out on this thing. And so people are really fired up. So, no, I don't think you can be overly intense at all.
Okay, good. I can get more intense. I can.
Yeah.
And it's just, we're going to talk about this. It flies in the face of common sense when you're talking about an affordable housing crisis to consistently be putting dictates down that are going to make homes more expensive. It just flies in the face of that. We talked yesterday on the show about the same thing with, you know, some of the landlord-tenant laws about, you know, putting things down that are just going to increase the cost for renters. Yeah. So nonsensical. Before we get to that, though, you mentioned an event you were at this past weekend. We are going to have an event coming up this Saturday in Bellevue. What has the enthusiasm been out there for signing Initiative 2066?
Well, the reports we're getting from those who are volunteering and the paid signature gatherers that we have a mix of folks out there. And over the weekend, we were in about 300 different locations across the state. And the reports we're getting back from them is that people are lining up to sign this. This is, you know, oftentimes, you know, you see signature gatherers out there and they have to spend, you know, a few minutes kind of explaining what the issue is to people and maybe convincing them a little bit about signing. That is not the case here. This is a very easy issue for people to understand. This is about protecting natural gas service in their homes and their businesses. You know, the legislature is determined to cut off natural gas as an energy source for people, and this prevents them from doing that. So it's very easy to understand, and people are motivated. As I said, they have a very visceral reaction to this, and people are lining up to sign. So the signing rate that we're getting at those locations is much larger than it typically would be for an initiative, which is outstanding to hear. But as you know, we've got a very short time frame to get this done. So we need that intensity. We need people not to wait. If they see an opportunity to sign, take that opportunity, because you know, we've only got a few weeks left to get the required number of signatures. So this event on Saturday that you mentioned is really important. Appreciate you being there to help support us in that. We'll be in Bellevue from 9 to 2, you know, and people can just drive over or drive by if they see the signs, swing in, take a quick minute to sign, and then go up out their day. But it's really important.
Yeah, it is. And it is a quick timeline. You mentioned something there that I think is important, and what the anti-2066 side is going to and is already saying. This isn't a ban. We didn't try to ban natural gas. What are you talking about, Brandy? But you said, you know, the legislature is dead set on doing this. So for people who hear that argument and say, oh, this wasn't, you know, what we did this last legislative session, we didn't ban natural gas. What is your argument against that?
Well, they're being very disingenuous. I mean, as you know, the governor has been intent on banning natural gas for a number of years. He's looked at different avenues for doing that. For us who build new residential construction, we've been fighting this at the Washington State Building Code Council that determines the building and energy code that our members have to build to when they're building new construction. And they have banned natural gas in all new and commercial construction with the new energy code that went into effect this past year. So now with House Bill 1589 that they passed this last session, the legislature made it very clear that they are determined to ban natural gas. And this is the start of the process. If you look at the debate that took place on that House bill, the sponsor of the bill said in the debate on the House floor, this is the start of the process of banning natural gas. That is their ultimate goal. So I'm not going to get into, you know, the arguments of whether 1589 is a gas ban or not. It clearly is designed and intended to lead to a natural gas ban. And PSE is right there. You know, they stepped in. They knew the legislature was determined to do this. So they stepped in and cut a deal with the legislature to be the first and largest utility. It was in the legislature's interest to get the state's largest utility on board. And it was in Puget Sound Energy's interest to make sure that they could pass all those costs for their conversion onto their customers in higher rates to pay for it, and then ultimately make sure that it's the customers who have to pay for that cost of conversion of their homes when natural gas gets shut off. So there is no doubt that they are determined to do this, and really the only way to stop that from happening is to pass Initiative 2066.
I'm glad to hear you approach it like that. Like, we're not even going to entertain that. We're not going to entertain the disingenuous lies. You've said it yourselves. You want to move away from it. 1589, was it a ban in name? No, but that is the intent. And so I like that strategy. Like, let's not even entertain that. You mentioned something there that speaks to a question I get most often about this, which is, why would PSE want to move away from natural gas?
Well, I think, one, you know, they're not the same PSE that they used to be. This is now a foreign owned utility. It's not the, you know, locally owned utility that PSE used to be. So they don't really have an interest in serving their customers as much anymore. They're trying to make money. And they saw that the legislature was intent on doing this. And so they went in to make sure that their backs were covered financially, right? That they were not going to have to bear the cost of making this transition. They were able to pass it along and make sure that their customers are going to pay for this. And that, as I said, is, you know, PSE has a lot of, you know, costs themselves to make the transition from natural gas service to all electrification, increasing the grid, increasing their delivery system, all of those, you know, hard costs that they have to pay. And they wanted to ensure that the legislature and ultimately UTC and the governor was going to support them passing those costs on to customers, that they wouldn't have to bear those themselves. And so that's why PSC stepped in to cut this deal on 1589. That was their motivation for being involved. As I said, the legislature had the motivation of getting the state's largest utility provider to buy into this deal as a first step to then forcing ultimately all of the other providers around the state to ban natural gas and move to all electrification. So so that's what happened during the legislative session. But again, you know, this is a positive initiative. This is about protecting choice for consumers. And this is about protecting an energy resource that millions in this state rely on as an alternative to electricity. You know, when the power goes out, people need something to be able to heat and cook in their homes. Natural gas has provided that backup energy source for a lot of folks when that happens. So this is a safety issue as well. But this is about protecting consumer choice. And consumers should have the option to be able to choose what is the best resource for them. And that's what Initiative 2066 does. And it's why we need to get the signatures and get it on the ballot and pass it in November.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, I've personally, I'm not trying to speak for you, but just had enough of energy policy, the cost being put on the backs of working class people. And I don't know about you, Greg, and we'll end here, but have you heard any explanation from the majority party about how they suggest a working class family pay out of pocket $40,000 plus to electrify their home? Is there any plan to help them with that?
Not that I've heard of. And, you know, I don't know how they justify it, to be honest with you, either, Brandy. You know, these are politics is so completely upside down these days. You know, this is, you know, the party that for decades and decades said they were for working class people, you know, for the little guy, all of that. Their policies were around protecting the cost of living for those folks or helping people move up. I mean, that was all the rhetoric, right? It's now completely turned on its head. You know, climate policy that has been approved by this legislature or pushed by this governor now means that we have the fourth highest cost of groceries in the entire country. We have the third highest gasoline prices. In fact, I heard a report over the weekend that we are now $1 per gallon over the average cost of gasoline in the rest of the country here in Washington. We have the third highest medium price sale for homes. So, and it's all these climate policies that are, you know, driving up all of these costs that hit lower and middle income people, you know, more dramatically than they do others. And so I don't understand at all how, you know, they can justify increasing the cost for working people and folks on fixed income. And now they want to go after utility rates and make those the highest in the country, probably in the end. And then also force people, as you say, to cover the cost of conversion. And for somebody who's on, you know, a fixed income that paid off their home 20 years ago and is retired, how are they supposed to come up with $40,000 to $70,000?
They can't.
To pay that cost? They can't.
They can't. And
then they won't be able to sell their home because they're going to have to do that cost before they can sell it. They're just going to get trapped. And it's not fair to folks at all.
It's wild. And that's why we want, and we're going to give working class people a choice. We're going to give them, that's all it is, give them a choice in November to decide if they want to proceed down this route. I tend to think the slogan "Vote Yes, Pay Less" is resonating with a lot of people who are struggling right now. We're going to give them a chance to vote yes, pay less at the gas pump, getting rid of the Climate Commitment Act, vote yes, pay less on this and protect gas. So, Greg, thank you guys for jumping on board and putting the weight of the BIAW behind this as well. I love to see when trade groups get involved this aggressively in doing it, and it's really going to help. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Appreciate all your help on this. And it's very important to our members. As you said at the beginning, you know, the mission of BIAW is to get as many people into home ownership opportunity as possible. We want to keep the cost of home ownership down and make it attainable for as many people as possible. And this issue fits right in line with that. So our members are strongly supportive of Initiative 2066.
Amen. So take the time and come out and see us on Saturday. Again, 222 112th Avenue Northeast in Bellevue. We're going to be there, Nicole and I, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Hell, maybe somebody can even bring me lunch.
Unless it's raining. Just kidding. We'll be there.
Bring me coffee or something. You know, I'm going to, so around 10 a.m., I really get my second coffee fix desire. And then around 1:30 p.m., I feel like I have to take a nap. So we'll see if I can get through both those
things. It is pretty shocking how much caffeine you can still sleep on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll do a double shot of espresso at night at like 5 p.m. just to get something done, and then I'll go to bed, and it's just fine. So anyway, I hope I see you guys there and get that initiative signed. All right, speaking of all the money the government is costing us, absolutely bleeding us dry, if you want to save a little bit of money, but you've looked at your family's budget and you're like, where do I cut from? I've cut everything. Before you cut the Undivided podcast, because I realize that it's $5 a month, take a look at your insurance. Do the First Mark Challenge, firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com, because you need insurance, right? You can't just cut insurance. But when you have an insurance broker like First Mark on your team, they have a bunch, they're not a captive carrier, so they can shop a bunch of different insurance companies for you and figure out if they can get you a better rate for your homeowner's insurance, for your car insurance. Casey in Covington says he did the First Mark Challenge. They saved him 37% off their auto quote. Ben and Leslie says First Mark saved them over $1,500 a year, which is substantial. And it just takes you a little bit of time. So a couple things. Doing the First Mark Challenge is totally free. Again, just takes you a little bit of time. And you never pay First Mark a dime for their services. It's the insurance companies that have to pay them for bringing your business to them. So firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. Take the First Mark Challenge today. The very best part is they work for you. All right. We skipped Unbelievable yesterday, so we've got to fit it in today. Although Nicole told me I spent 30 minutes off the top of the show ranting about Crosscut. I get going and I can't believe that was 30 minutes. I'm having a freaking blast. I'm having so much fun doing this. Thank you guys for letting us do this. Like I said earlier, before I get to Unbelievable, isn't it fun? When you were in the media, it's funny because when you're in the mainstream media and people are like, oh, you're corporate media bought and sold by Fox News and all this stuff. And then you go out on your own and you rely on like the kindness of supporters to support your show and they still attack you. Like before, the left attacked me for being, you know, paid by Fox News and Rupert Murdoch. And now it's like, well, now we get most of our money from people who pay $5 a month and you're still vilifying me. So maybe it wasn't who was paying my paycheck. Maybe it was always what I was saying and that you didn't like it. All right. In our segment Unbelievable today, a local journalist requested documentation, public records on the Climate Commitment Act. And she was told not only would it take up to 2 years to receive them, but it could cost her $2 million. Let's discuss in our segment, Unbelievable. Boop. All right. Shauna Sowersby is a government reporter for McClatchy. And McClatchy is kind of like an Associated Press in that they do reporting and it goes out to a bunch of different publications. And I think Shauna does a good job. She's done some really good stories. She's been one of the few journalists that has been very, very hard on Democrats in Olympia over their efforts to make it more difficult for us to get public records. So I do want to give her a lot of credit for that. Well, boy, did she file a whopper of a public disclosure request. Now, let me characterize this in my way because I don't want to put words in her mouth because she certainly doesn't say any of this. I really look at this and I think, wow, they do not want you to find out what's happening with the Climate Commitment Act before you vote on whether to repeal it in November. That's how I see this. So Shauna said on Twitter, I requested records from the Washington Department of Licensing regarding revenues and funds collected from the Climate Commitment Act gas tax and was quoted $2 million for one method of retrieving those documents to be released over a period of 2 years. So basically what they did based on what she requested is they came back and they said, okay, we have a couple different options here for you to consider when it comes to how we're going to fulfill, journalist, your legal public records request. It says primary documentation of refunds for businesses and individuals housed in our primary system of record is what you're requesting. The estimated total is 648,000 records based on tax cycle periods and customer volume. So they said one option is that they could make a custom data inquiry to extract all responsive refund records, housed in DOL's database. And if you choose this, it's going to take 2 years and $2 million. So basically, yeah, we'll create a whole system just to extract the data that you're looking for. And you'll have to pay us $2 million to do that. Option number two, an alternate manual extraction. DOL staff would manually go in and extract those records. The electronic transmittal fees would be 5 cents every four records. It will take approximately 5 years to do that, and it will cost $8,100 to fulfill, which also isn't very good. Or you could get copies of paper records, such as individual tax refund documents that were received and retained as hard copies. A rough estimate is 12,500 pages. The scanning fees are 10 cents per page. The total would be $1,250 and nearly 2 years to fulfill. I love it how they give her the option of the $2 million one. Like, the $2 million one would take 2 years, but also the hand scanning would take 2 years. One would cost $2 million and the other would cost $1,200. Like, gee, wonder which of those options she'd pursue. This is absurd. And this is really, we haven't talked about it a lot. We have our ongoing public records lawsuit against the city of Seattle, and that's because we want to be respectful of the process and of the court proceedings and all of that stuff. And certainly when it comes to a conclusion, we'll discuss it. But one of the underlying issues in our case, and I think is relevant here, is the law says that public entities have to provide fullest assistance. They have to provide fullest assistance at reasonable cost to be able to get the media and members of the public alike records that they're entitled to get. Remember, they're our records. We're simply requesting them from the government that works for us. But one of the things I think a lot of these government entities do is, one, they're incompetent, right? They haven't, you know, a tech company could in a second find a way to get those records for her, probably in a day. But the government's entirely incompetent. And so it has these really laborious systems of fulfilling public records requests in a way that are unduly burdensome. And therefore, I don't believe amount to fullest assistance under the requirements of the law. But again, I look at this and I think that's got Jay Inslee's hands all over it. Like, let's make this system so difficult to track that if anyone wants to take a closer look at it, it's going to cost them $2 million in 2 years to do it. So Shauna Sowersby certainly isn't getting those records and that information before you go to the ballot in November and decide whether you want to repeal the CCA. But hey, maybe you just repeal it and the records aren't necessary.
There we go. Or start a GoFundMe. Because either way, we need to see that.
Or start a GoFundMe. Yeah. But I mean, you know, just let's just do this. Let's just repeal the CCA. And then we don't have to argue over whether, you know, Senator Leas is lying about the CCA. We don't have to argue over whether Jay Inslee is lying about the gas price increases from the CCA. We don't have to have Shauna go through a whole $2 million ordeal to get records. Let's just do away with it. Like, wouldn't that make everything so much easier and cheaper? Unbelievable. All right, dipping right into national news, but this national news has, and yes, we're going late today, okay? Because I just, let's get into some national news, but it has a little bit of a local tie. This from the Chicago Sun-Times. And it's talking about Evanston, Illinois. Evanston's reparations program violates equal protection in U.S. constitutional lawsuit claims. So in Evanston, Illinois, now they are saying this is a first of its kind reparations program in the country. We've said that Washington State has a first of its kind reparations program. The programs are different. But to me, they have the same underlying problem, and that is that I believe that they're unconstitutional. So it says, approved by the Evanston City Council in 2021, the program provides up to $25,000 to Black residents with ties to the community between 1919 and 1969. Payments were initially designated only for housing costs, but the city expanded the program last year to include an option for direct cash payments. This is from the Judicial Watch president, Tom Fitton, and Judicial Watch has now sued. He told the Chicago Sun-Times, the program is nothing more than a ploy to redistribute tax dollars to individuals based on race. This scheme unconstitutionally discriminates against anyone who does not identify as Black or African American. This class action lawsuit, civil rights lawsuit, will be a historic defense of our colorblind constitution. And so it goes in to say more about this nonprofit, again, Judicial Watch, which we're going to reach out to Tom Fitton, actually, because I'm curious. I'll get into our reparations program, but it seems like there are some issues here. So they filed the federal lawsuit last week on behalf of six residents who are not Black, but whose relatives lived in Evanston between 1919 and 1969, and that is the 50-year period of housing discrimination that caused segregation of Black residents in the city. And so the argument here, it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment because the program uses race as a requirement for eligibility. And that is an issue. I have said, if the government wants to make individual people whole again, like, that's grounds for a lawsuit. Hey, government, you discriminated against my family, and I'm going to sue you for compensation for that discrimination. That's different. You have a claim there. That's not race-based. That's impact-based. So I'm fine with reparations like that done via a lawsuit. But when you're just wholesale saying, ah, if you have some sort of tie to the community, even if you can't prove you were impacted in any sort of way by segregation in this 50-year period, we'll give you $25,000 cash. Come on, that's unconstitutional. And so my question is, and would be for Judicial Watch, do you think we could have a similar lawsuit here? So we broke the news that had gone completely under the radar that as of January 1st this year, if you're buying a home in Washington State, you're paying reparations. There's an added recorder's fee of $100 per record that you're paying into. So that's like $700, $800, $900 per home purchase. And that money goes into a fund that's given to first-time home buyers of color. So you can't benefit from it if you're white. And it doesn't require that those home buyers prove definitively that they were harmed by segregation. So I'm very curious what happens in Illinois. It seems like if that's knocked down, then there would be a pretty good chance that a lawsuit against our law here would be successful. All right, it is Thursday after all, and so we're going to check in on what's happening in Florida with my sister. Some really interesting, good news out of Florida as it pertains to what they've been doing with their education system and making sure that families have a choice when it comes to how their kids are educated with their own tax money. Let's talk about it in our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Miranda, hello.
Hello.
We've been using a picture of you with an alligator in our closing credits, and I need to somehow incorporate it into our Florida show open.
Yeah, you do. Maybe you can, instead of just the alligator meowing, it could be me and the gator meowing.
Okay, we'll work on that. All right, so let's get into it. A couple of Florida stories that reflect some issues that we've been talking about here in Washington State. You know, the state of our school system is pretty bad. Democrats in the Washington Education Association, they're very opposed to school choice. But in Florida, school choice seems to be helping kids thrive.
Yeah, and it's not just helping kids thrive. The program itself is thriving. People are really, like, taking advantage of this. It basically, we talked about it last year, I think, when he put these scholarships in place, where basically, like, each kid is worth a certain amount of money in the school system. Like, that's how much money it takes to, like, educate this kid. And the money follows the kid. So if you apply for these grants or these scholarships and get approved for them, you can take that money and apply it to charter school or a private school or even home and neighborhood schooling. And people are really taking advantage of this. I even have a couple friends who are able to keep their kids in private school because of this extra funding that they're getting for not having their kids in a public school. But on the other side of it, it is scaring some public school districts into thinking they're going to have to close some of their campuses. But at the end of the day, like, if parents choose to take their kids to a better education, like, that's on the public school for not, you know, stepping up to what these parents and kids are expecting of their education.
Exactly. It's wild to me. If the idea behind education is making sure that kids get what they need to thrive, and you're like, no, we have to have them in public schools, and we're going to force them to be in public schools by making it too expensive to do anything else. It's like, okay, so you're not, you know, if you were offering a good education to kids, then you wouldn't have issues with declining in enrollment. You wouldn't have to close public schools. Seattle's has to close like around 20 elementary schools because enrollment has gone down. And I imagine it would be so much more if parents could get financial assistance to put their kids in a private school or in a charter school or even homeschool them. So it's just funny. It's like forcing someone, they want a monopoly on education because if there wasn't a monopoly, people wouldn't choose them.
It's true. And I also think that this could eventually even out to be beneficial in both ways. Because, like, you and I went to a public school, but we went to a public school in a small town. So we were able to have small classrooms, more personalized education because our teachers knew us. So, like, maybe they just need smaller campuses so that the kids that do want to go to public school can still operate in a public school that's small enough to be ran by the money that's still being sent there. But now you're having less kids in the classroom. And to me, that just creates a higher standard for education when it comes around full circle. So.
Yeah. Yeah, well, God forbid they get what they want, you know, the small classrooms that all teachers want and deserve, frankly. But it's like, okay, we are going to have small classrooms because kids don't want to be here. So you really better show us that that education standards are high. Okay, another thing that I think is tied to, I mean, the opposite of what's happening in Washington State. We had in Oregon and Washington this month the fastest girls in track were boys at the state meets. Boys won the state championship titles at in both Washington and Oregon in their respective races. And so in Florida, they're making this switch in this distinction when it comes to sports between sex and gender. Can you explain?
Yeah, so they're basically replacing the mentions of the word gender with the word sex, just so that it doesn't have that you know, gray area of being with the, like, identifying as or with your sexual orientation. And I think that they're doing this, to protect, like, girls and boys just being able to have privacy in their locker rooms, being able to have opportunities in athletics to succeed and win and go to school and get scholarships for that. It's such a touchy thing because I just don't know what they're going to do with this, but for now, Florida is going to go ahead and stand their ground. And I don't know. I know that there's a federal policy about discrimination and they're trying to include gender in that as a discrimination, but then they're making that no distinction on if that's with identity. And some Florida people are a little bit worried that that could mean that Florida is not going to get some funding from the federal government if they decide to not abide by this law. So, but I don't think Florida cares. I think Florida's going to stand their ground regardless when it comes to this.
Well, it's an interesting fix, but it's very simple, but it's actually pretty profound because, as you know, people claim gender's fluid. You know, gender's whatever I feel I am. They're like, okay, well, when we'll say your sex, your biological sex and not your gender. And then you can't try to finagle your way into competing against a female athlete. Florida, man, we got to do something here. And I don't think they're going to do what Florida does, but it's interesting to see some of the solutions to what's going on with the gender ideology. All right, one more. 104-year-old woman saved from a gator.
Yes, did you save her? In Florida. Huh?
Did you save her? I've seen you wrestle an alligator.
I did. So. That's what this head's from. No, I'm just kidding. No, I didn't save her, but our boys in blue came to the rescue and arrested this gator.
Oh, hey, buddy. We can't cuff him, but you're under arrest. You got to leave the grandmas alone. We're going to take you downtown. Let's go.
This is a little old lady and she was scared to leave her house. So she had to call the police to have them come in and help her get rid of this nuisance gator that was just hanging around her yard.
Oh, that's so sweet. It's so funny. In Seattle, first of all, if you called the cops for wildlife, they'd be like, go away. We don't have the time for that. But I just want to know, like, when I've been to some SPD training as part of stories and stuff, and I want to know if Florida law enforcement has to go through, like, how to wrangle a gator training or if that's an on-the-job experience, because I bet that they don't encounter that irregularly.
No. And honestly, I like to believe that there has to be some sort of like protocol in place for dealing with alligators and snakes here, because it is something that I like every day when I'm researching for the show, there is always a gator story. And I try not to press them on every week because I'm like, there's so many gator encounters here, but some of them are just a little bit better than others, and this one's pretty good.
I'd rather encounter a gator than a crackhead. You know, that's what police are wrangling here, the drug addicts. So at least the police are showing up and it's an alligator who means well, you know, just minding his own business. All right, Miranda, we appreciate you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
I love those cops. Can't handcuff you, but so cute. Gotta leave the old grannies alone. All right, have you noticed that fast food prices are insane? So somebody tell me, if you're a fast food regular, I mean, occasionally I'll do a Taco Time or something. It's been a hot minute since I've been to a McDonald's. But I was reading an article about how McDonald's Big Macs are like $9 in some places. $9. And it, you know, McDonald's isn't the only one. There's all these fast food franchises that are worried that they're going to go under because they cannot, nobody's coming to McDonald's to buy a $10 hamburger. But the issue is, of course, inflation. So the cost of all the ingredients to make those things goes up. You're operating on thin margins. You have to be making money on those things. So I'm curious if you guys have seen this issue firsthand. But I asked Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital, who joins us every week to talk about issues in the economy, to weigh in on the rising cost of fast food.
I think the U.S. economy has been very, quote unquote, resilient, but it's so much tied to the amount of money that the government is pouring into a system. But you're starting to see, in our opinion, I think you're starting to see what we call the lag reaper starting to take effect, right? This is why governments can't spend themselves into prosperity, because eventually any of the benefits, they become a game of diminishing returns, right? And so you're kind of seeing that in order for these guys to maintain profit margins, they've got to push the incremental price of the products they're selling to a level that is beyond the reach of the average consumer. And, you know, free market capitalism isn't a perfect system, but the reason we've stuck with it is because it's better than everything else we've tried. And it seems like we have to relearn that lesson every 10 or 20 years or so in this country. Every single problem is the answer is to print money. And what we're starting to see is the end of that road, right? Meaning you reach a point where you print and you just raise incremental costs that much. So on a real basis, you've done nothing. You've just incurred more debt.
When's the last time we had a McDonald's Big Mac?
You know what? It's been a while. I think the last time I had one was with my sons. I think we were having a guy's night. Mom and my daughter were gone somewhere. And we went to McDonald's. I actually had the double Big Mac with the four patties on it.
Oh, I didn't even know they had that.
Well, they don't normally. It's a special menu item.
Oh, you have to ask. You have to request it.
Yeah, and you had to fill out a 30-day financing program for it. It was like, I think it cost me about $1.50 a day.
Yeah,
you
know, apparently.
Buy now, pay later, of course.
Since we're talking about inflation, just one more pitch for your seminar on inflation, which is happening today at 3:30.
Yes. So it's our normal road show, but right, Know Your Risk Radio. We're always talking about risk management. It's the center of every single thing that we do. And ironically, we're just kind of switching the risks. So when you look at an economy, there are three basic risks to any economic setup: inflation, deflation, and stagflation. And so, you know, at the front of most people's minds, post 2008-2009 has been the idea of asset prices falling or deflationary events. Those are really the only type of bad economic events we've experienced here in the United States over the last 40 years. What we're starting to realize is the you know, damaging impacts of inflation, and that is a risk. But like every other risk, there's ways to mitigate it. And so we're going to talk about how we're mitigating that risk in our clients' portfolios. And also, people think it's crazy that we do this, but even if you don't have us manage your money, I think that there's going to be several things that you can learn how to manage your own money and incorporate, you know, risk management as far as protecting yourself against inflation as well. So just trying to educate people and sound the alarm bell that, hey, you know, we need to be conscientious of taking losses, but we also need to look at how well our portfolio can stand up to the impacts that you and I are talking about. Because I think if you look at America structurally, I think that these risks and these problems are going to be here for a while. So something we got to pay attention to.
Yeah. So as you plan for retirement, absolutely have to take inflation into mind. So if you want a learning experience on that and just even an opportunity to pick Zach's brain about what to do, they're having that live inflation webinar, one of their free Know Your Risk webinars today at 3:30 p.m. You can still sign up. Just go to knowyourriskradio.com, knowyourriskradio.com. It pops right up for you and you just click on sign up. Investment advisory services are offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results. Trek 24244. Go to knowyourriskradio.com. All right. Questions and comments. We got some super chats. We'll roll right through here. Matthew Cook, I'm here for scorched earth brandy. I have been a little scorched earth. Oh. The only friends I need are you, my husband, some of our other friends, obviously, in case they watch this, my dogs, and all of you guys.
That's it.
And I'm sorry, if you've stuck with me this long, I don't know what, I don't think there's anything I could say that would scare you away at this point, because I've said a lot of things and I've changed my opinion on things over the years. So the people who are here for a reason. They don't need some purity out of me or whatever it is. And they know that I never sell my thoughts and my beliefs. There's no price on that. Boo Boo Bear, well, maybe $1 billion. Maybe $1 billion. Maybe then I'd sell my opinion. Boo Boo Bear says $10. Thank you, old sub Sailor with $20 super chat. Inslee is trying to save his legacy. Fergie's trying to get elected. Bird is trying to save his reputation. So Undivided has a lot of targets on it. Stang screwed up. The truth hurts them all. Great job, Brandy and Nicole. Thank you. Robert Parker with $5 super chat. Don't forget the Democrats' styrofoam ban goes into effect on 6-1. No more styrofoam cups, takeout containers, plates, and similar starting 6-1-2024. Look, I don't care per se. I don't like styrofoam. It gives me the heebie-jeebies. Like, it's like the nails on a chalkboard thing. Just like...
Right.
You know?
But it is going to make the cost of the food that you order right. or take out cost more yeah. because it's cheap.
It's cheap to make. Yeah, you go to Met Market. I went to Met Market the other day, and they have these beautiful, like, nice... compostable containers with its nice little lid, and it's so fancy. I'm like,
but it's Met
Market. Paying for that. I'm paying for that for yep. sure. TZ Burton, $5 super chat. Brandy, Dave Reichert asked me to give this to you. I can't accept it. I can't accept it. Send it back. Leland Taylor, $10 super chat. Brandy, Kate Teodoro had a good question. How do we go about getting an initiative going to protect female sports? It recently hit home for us over here in Okanagan County. You just got to start one. Anyone can run an initiative for the filing fee, which I don't think they've tried to increase, right? Because they want fewer people to run initiatives. You just got to start one. That's where it starts. Marla says, when you're attacked by the left and the right, you're definitely doing something right. Keep up the great work. And look, either when you're attacked by the left and the right, you're just terrible and everyone hates you, or, you know, you're angering the right kind of people. And I'm fine with that. But I'll always admit, if I get something wrong and there's a legitimate criticism, fine. I said in the John Tsang story, one of the things I did get wrong is I thought they bought a big 2,000-acre forest, but it was a bunch of little pieces. So John told me that. I looked it up. He was right. I was wrong. That's fine. But there's a lot of other mistruths in that story, or half-truths, or things he blindly overlooked that I gave him the information on. Like, come on, hold powerful people accountable. Yes, I guess I'm a powerful person in the sense that we can influence public opinion on things, but you're talking about state senator and you're giving him the benefit of the doubt that, oh no, he's just trying to warn people that these public transportation projects could lose money. He has no nefarious intent on that. Give me a freaking break. Couple more, Exhibit Truth. We just built an EV semi-truck charging station in California. I drove past it all the time. I haven't seen an EV semi-truck there yet. I think it's just to say it's done for campaign clout. Let me see. CP Crosscut and those attacking you, Brandy, are attacking you because they're wrong and have no alternative. They're pathetic. They're attacking us because we're effective. Sorry, I know that sounds big-headed. They're attacking us because we're effective. Our podcast is growing. I think that we do a good job at explaining these issues, at pushing back against some of these policies or politicians or candidates or whatever it is, and they don't like that. They don't want us to have an audience to push the agenda that of common sense that we're trying to push. It bothers them. And so they're going to attack us, and that's fine. If their attacks are ever legitimate, absolutely. If you ever have questions, by the way, about the funding for this show, I mean, am I going to open up my bank account for people to look through? No. But I've been transparent about the funding for this show. We have 7 advertisers. Just like most media outlets take advertising money. We have 7 advertisers. If you see us read an ad for someone on the show, they paid for that. We didn't do it for free. Oh, real shocking stuff. And then we have thousands of subscribers who pay $5 a month. And it's because of that revenue, I'm able to do this full time and Nicole's able to do this full time. And we can pay Daryl and we can pay Miranda and we can pay for all this stuff around us. So we appreciate it, but nobody's buying our opinion. There's a big difference between advertising money and taking money from someone to say something, which we would never do, obviously. Okay, with that, I think we shall get to our closing sanity check, another Fetterman moment of sanity. So a couple things here. Found out John Fetterman went to Harvard. Didn't know that. But he was doing the commencement address at Yeshiva University, private school in New York. It sounded like, from the reaction of the crowd to what he had to say, probably an awful lot of Jewish students there, fair to say. So he got up there, and he's been just on point in all this anti-Semitism, and he did something that earned him a standing ovation for sanity.
And I was reflecting, and it's like, where's my last graduation? And that was literally a quarter century ago, 25 years ago. And I was graduating from Harvard University. But today, I have been profoundly disappointed the way Harvard's inability to stand up for the Jewish community after the COVID. personally, I do not fundamentally believe that it's right for me to wear this today.
Ovation for John Fetterman, who's all of a sudden the king of sanity, removes his Harvard Crimson Hood during his commencement address in solidarity for people who have been victimized by anti-Semitism. Love it. That has been our show for today. That has been our sanity check. That has been our show today. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We have two great guests for you coming up on Sundays with subscribers. We're going to have Joan Mell, who is the attorney representing former Tacoma police officer Timothy Rankin, who was acquitted of murder, but whose life has been so difficult in the days since, he has had to change his appearance because of threats to him and his family. We're also going to be joined by our friend Jason Rantz, who broke that blockbuster report on Semi Byrd and has been vilified for it by some on the right. So I'm going to talk to him about his reporting, about some of the blowback, and about some other stories that he has broken recently. So we'll see you there. If you're not a subscriber already, you can sign up to support the show, undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com, for just $5 a month. We will see subscribers on Sunday. We'll see the rest of you on Monday.